It's the morning show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. President Trump had only positive things to say about the negotiations with North Korea. He said the meeting marked the beginning of a terrific relationship between the U.S. and North Korea. Here's Trump after the summit.
It's going great. We had a really fantastic meeting. A lot of progress. Really very positive. I think better than anybody could have expected. Top of the line. Really good.
We're talking to Bruce Gentleson. He's a professor of public policy and political science at Duke University. He's an expert on U.S. foreign policy and is the former senior advisor in the State Department between 2009 and 2011. Bruce, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
So we are taking your calls this morning, 800-642-1234. Were you surprised that North Korea signed an agreement? Did you expect that that would happen? Do you think North Korea will follow through on its stated intent to denuclearize? Do you think the U.S. and North Korea will continue to have improved relations? Or is this just kind of a flash in the pan? Remember that Trump loved Justin Trudeau just about a year ago. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Bruce, they did sign an agreement in this historic summit, and this agreement did say that they would work towards complete denuclearization?
Yeah, it's interesting. I did wake up really early and heard on BBC President Trump's press conference and was listening and hearing all these extremely positive things about the agreement. And when I finally got up and got my coffee, and got a copy of it, that was in the media, there was a real discrepancy. I mean, the agreement really doesn't say anything. It talks about this being a historic summit and how great it was to meet, uses very vague language. And if you were looking at this, it's at most the preamble, a very long preamble, to something that needs to have, like, okay, what else is here? And not all the details, but at least a roadmap of where to go. And this really isn't. It's just a sort of agreement to, sort of be happy about what happened in Singapore.
So there is no roadmap. This is just an agreement to be friends and maybe keep talking.
Well, I'll give you two examples from the agreement. One is that President Trump committed to provide security guarantees to North Korea. And the issue there is, for North Korea, the nuclear weapons are really like a life insurance policy. There's a sense that the United States would not do regime change as long as they had nuclear weapons. And they would need real security guarantees to go forward. It doesn't say what they are. It doesn't say, what they are in relation to our commitment to South Korea. It's hard to know that it would be credible, given that President Trump had reneged on the agreement that his predecessor, President Obama, made with Iran, or an agreement that we made, President Bush made with Libya in 2003 with Gaddafi, and then 8 years later we invaded. We need to have some sense of what they are. And then it talks about complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. And that phrasing is really interesting, because from a North Korean perspective, when it talks about the peninsula, not just the country itself, it could include, for example, the security guarantees we give to South Korea to put them under our nuclear umbrella. And so we don't know what either one of those means, even close to what they mean.
Does North Korea hope to gain something from this, and what do they hope to gain?
I think they've gained already. For President Kim, who, not just by President Trump, but a year or two ago was seen as a very odd young man. Some people saw him as, almost a caricature, hanging out with Dennis Rodman and the like. He now is appearing on the world stage. What's happened, he's now had his first meeting with the Chinese president. They've actually met twice. Vladimir Putin paid him a visit. So he actually now can conduct his own diplomacy broadly, not just with us. And that compares with President Trump, who kind of shows up after having had huge fights, which is probably the nice way of saying it, with our closest allies and others. And, if you're Kim, you say, if that's the way he treats his friends, how's he going to treat me over time? So Kim has already gained in stature, and Trump looks like he's, kind of feeding his own ego by saying how great it is to have a meeting, but not really doing the things that need to be done to make the world safer.
We are talking about the North Korean summit, and we're also talking about the G7 summit that Bruce just referred to. We are taking your calls, 1-800-642-1234. What do you think about this North Korea summit? What do you think about the trade issues that we're having with Canada and our European allies? 1-800-642-1234. ideas@WPR.org. Bruce, this establishes new North Korean U.S. relations. Peace, did it say anything about peace on the peninsula or just denuclearization?
It does talk about peace. It talks about building a lasting, stable peace regime, which would entail a lot of things. You know, the Korean War ended in 1953 with an armistice, and if you go, as I have, to the demilitarized zone, there's still troops on both sides. Mm. So you'd really have to formally end the Korean War, which involves not just us in North Korea, but South Korea, China, directly and others indirectly. It would, have to figure out where the peninsula goes. Do they unify like happened in Germany? And what happens to countries like Japan that are affected by this, that have their own issues, like the abduction of Japanese citizens by the North Koreans? So there are many elements, and, there's no way that any summit would resolve them all. But if you go back to the way we started relations with China, with Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon, the first meeting that Kissinger had with Zhou Enlai, the number two in China, they met for 41 hours. And talked about lots of details. And then when Nixon and Mao met, it was a roadmap, and it really framed our relations, and whatever our issues are between us today, almost 50 years later, it's kept things kind of on the highway and not breaking down. And so it's a huge contrast. And I think the press conference had its value for President Trump. My bet is he's probably going to start tweeting from the plane, because the coverage is starting to go in the other direction now.
In the other direction in terms of what?
Much more criticism than just the initial headline of we struck a deal, we shook hands, and now as people are looking at both the text of the agreement. South Korea, for example, one thing that President Trump said was that we agreed to stop the military exercises, which we call war games, and the South Korean president has said, well, we weren't consulted on that. That's very important to us. The American Pacific Command military also said, we weren't told about this, and we have no idea what the policy change is. So it's coming from a lot of directions, not just, people that Trump believes are his opponents, but, people that are affected by this and in many respects share the same goal. But are starting to ask tough questions about whether or not this moves the ball in the right direction.
Okay, so now I have a question. If Trump comes home and speaks to his military commanders, and his military commanders say, we can't do this, and somehow convince him that we can't stop doing war games, and he changes his mind because he does that, what does Kim Jong-un think about that?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Carrie, because I think that it will reinforce the notion that Trump is not a man of his word, which is what we're hearing from, your close neighbors in Canada, right?
Right.
And elsewhere. And my concern has been, and I wrote about this in an article yesterday, is that, if it breaks down and Trump is disappointed, that in some respects, given the way he makes decisions with a certain amount of reactiveness and irascibility, we could be back where we were a year ago or even worse in fire and fury kinds of crises. And that would be an understandable reaction from Kim saying, well, you said this and now you're not doing it. And when you don't have some key details established and you don't have the structure, the roadmap, the outline, there's plenty of room for honest misunderstanding, let alone intentional deception on both sides.
And we are talking about the summit that was held last night, late last night, our time, in Singapore on North Korea. We're also going to be talking a little later about the G7 summit. We are taking your calls this morning, 1-800-642-1234. What do you think about this summit? What do you think about trade with Canada and our other European allies? Do you think that Trump is going to keep his word on this? And there may actually be peace in Korea. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Bruce Gendelson is taking us through last night's historic summit between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. 800-642-1234 is the number that we want you to call to talk about this today. Or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Bruce, should it concern us that the two leaders met yesterday without the press there? And in their first meeting, they actually met without anybody else there, except interpreters.
Yeah, I, to be honest with you, I think it's okay to meet without the press there. The Kissinger, Zhou Enlai meetings that I talked about were actually secret until the first round in July 1971 happened. Sometimes it's a little bit like keeping a flower inside a greenhouse, and you got to get it strong enough to see the light outside. You do need to talk to the press at the end, like at least President Trump did. But negotiations really have to happen, without everything being shown on it while in effect the sausage is being made. The lack of aides, though, even the most prepared president, probably the most prepared foreign policy president we've had in ages since Franklin Roosevelt, was George H.W. Bush. And when he was negotiating with Gorbachev, he had, a whole team of aides. And it's not that, he would take their advice. Sometimes he'd agree, sometimes he'd disagree, but he'd have, the key data, the key facts, a range of views. And, Trump has, number one, surrounded himself by very scary people who believe the first option is military force, like his National Security Advisor, John Bolton.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, hasn't really fleshed out either the CIA or the State Department in terms of people that have expertise. And his notion of somehow, I know everything, it makes for great TV for a little while, but it really doesn't deliver.
Do you think that Trump has an end game here? Do you think that he has a goal that he wants that he can articulate?
I think that he loves the big event, and if you in his own press conference, he continually said nobody's done this before, and in the statement we were talking about earlier, it's about how historic it was. It says that, within one page about four or five times, and for him, the event is really not the means to the ends of a policy goal. It's the end in itself, and I think it gives him a sense that he's powerful and dominates the news cycles. But this is where the question of what happens now and does this huge sort of rollout get contradicted over time. And it's not just Trump. I mean, Kim Jong-un is not exactly a trustworthy person himself. And if it gets contradicted, then whatever benefits you got here on June 12th from your news cycle don't look so good as you go down the road.
I heard some speculation yesterday as we were doing they were going through the summit about this being a political ploy, that this is Trump's midterm strategy. What do you make of that? Is that too cynical?
I don't think this would be as central to it. I think that the strategy is to distract from the Mueller investigation and the Russia issues, which continue to more indictments and more revelations. And also to demonstrate, I think, that even if you think he may have done some things wrong in the campaign, look how important he is to America. This doesn't mobilize his base like the G7, you know, trade issues seem to do. So it's really more feeding the, well, I may have made some mistakes, but I'm indispensable because I made peace with North Korea. And that's where, if he delivered, I think we'd all be better off, and people, including people like myself who are critical of him. But I don't see a basis, I don't see a foundation in this agreement on which to then build the rest of the house.
So what about the way the president talks about the North Korean leader? About a year ago, he was calling him names, and now he says that they have developed a very special bond. We're going to play this clip.
I want to thank Chairman Kim. Spent a lot of time together today, very intensive time. And I would actually say that it worked out for both of us far better than anybody could have expected.
So what do you think of that language?
Yeah, I think some people say that, you know, be careful when you get too much praise, because you can turn around and, you know, like with his attorney general and a number of other people around him, it changes quickly. Worse than that, I think, was an interview he gave to ABC News as he was leaving, in which he talked about how much the North Korean people love their leader, which is really weird. You know, this is a country that's had starvation as a policy of its own people, not this leader, but his father, that still has gulags, that has enormous amount of indoctrination. Maybe this leader will open up the country a little bit over time, remains to be seen, but the notion that the people love their leader, you know, where is that coming from? And, you know, it's quite offensive for an American president to disregard human rights so much, and also in some respects to be seen as so gullible. It's almost like if you praise him, you can get him to say a whole lot of things. Saudi Arabia has done that a bunch of times. Mm. Israel's done it a bunch of times. It's, you know, it sort of reduces your leverage in terms of people taking your measure.
We've heard that thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in North Korea have been killed. Is that true? How reliable is the information coming out of there?
Best I can tell is over time, that's definitely true. I don't know that that's been happening as much in recent years. It's very hard to get information out of that country, but the starvation period was in the 90s. And, you know, to the extent that humanitarian health workers were let into the country, you had a whole generation, or not a whole generation, but an element of that generation who had been children whose growth was stunted, who'd managed to survive. It remains a very repressive country. You know, he, by all accounts, killed off, you know, I guess his half-brother, who was a challenger to power, killed some uncles that he didn't trust. We don't need a country to be a perfect democracy to deal with him. We have made agreements with countries that weren't. We've made some with the Soviet Union. We've made some with China. We've made some with a bunch of other countries. But to praise a leader and say that his people love him, when that's the record, there's a real disconnect there.
Trump also said last night or early this morning that this isn't the first time he has spoken with Kim, that he actually spoke with him on the phone. Did that surprise you?
Yeah, I don't know many details about that. You know, I know that there were the meetings that Secretary of State Pompeo had, and there was the exchange of letters. I don't know anything about that, and I suspect some reporters will dig into that to see whether it's true, and if so, does it tell us anything beforehand? They clearly, you know, they had this scripted before they went in. What's interesting is they had the skeleton of the agreement, but they couldn't put any meat on the bones other than these very vague statements that they made. There's nothing in there about verification, which, you know, Ronald Reagan, the hero of many conservatives in the country, his famous expression was, yes, trust, but also verify.
Right.
And to do that in North Korea, you know, with Iran, you had you didn't have nuclear weapons. You had a nuclear weapons program with a limited number of sites. You know, estimates of North Korea are they may have as many as 60 actual nuclear bombs, over 100 sites. And so to verify and dismantle that, you know, realistic estimates are 10 to 15 years with full cooperation. And there's very little recognition of that that came through the statements or the way that President Trump has been talking about it.
We are talking right now about the nuclear summit, or the Korean summit that just happened in Singapore. And we are taking your calls, 1-800-642-1234. Bruce Gendelson, we talked a little bit earlier about Japan and South Korea. The South Korean president actually had a hand in making this happen, didn't he?
Yeah, that's a really good point, because we tend to think anything that happens in the world is because of the United States. And this is a comment not just on the Trump years, but on any previous administration. And the current President Moon got elected to the presidency, and the principal part of his platform was to try to improve relations with North Korea. There had been another South Korean president about 20 years ago who got elected on that and made some progress, but you know, then it fell back. And they orchestrated the Olympics meetings. And also, one of the references in the Trump key statement is to the April 27th declaration that was signed by the two leaders of North and South Korea. And, you know, the reality is when we were back a year ago and people were worrying whether we were going down the road to war, and some people were saying, oh, the United States can win because we're stronger militarily. You know, the first 24 to 36 hours of that, you would lose, by many estimates, hundreds of thousands of people in South Korea because the artillery and rockets the North Koreans have in the, on the other side of the DMZ is only, you know, 30, 40 miles from Seoul, where mm-hmm. over 20 million people live. So South Korea's stakes are huge. Japan, you know, has some of these missile tests have flown over their islands. For us, it's still hypothetical, possibly down the road. And there have been abductions of Japanese citizens taken to North Korea. So they really have a lot of direct issues, and they're right there in the region. So they have interests at stake. And Prime Minister Abe actually has been kind of putting all his chips with Trump, which may be a mistake, whereas the South Korean president has been supporting the United States, but trying to have his own initiatives as well.
And he's been talking to not only North Korea, but he's been talking to China and other allies around the region, right?
Yeah, and China has stakes in this, too. Any notion that somehow North Korea is going to abandon China and become an American ally is just not going to happen. North Korea, most of their economy comes from China. China is, you know, a direct neighbor. China has relations with South Korea and has relations with Japan. This is not the old Cold War world where you're on one team or the other. And, you know, they've been playing their hands. There have been speculation about what their role is. They really did not like this young leader for many years. They thought he was unstable and dangerous. But now they're trying to figure out what their interests are. And we can't, you know, make this a more peaceful place without working with China. That's the reality. If they want to mess it up, they can. And if we try to play our hand so that somehow we make major gains against China by improving relations with North Korea, that's going to backfire.
So I'm wondering what North Korea's motivation is here. Their nuclear arsenal has been their only bargaining chip for a long time. So what made them maybe move towards giving that up?
I think the sense is that they had developed it to the point where they had high confidence in their capabilities. You know, as we were saying, they have quite a substantial arsenal. They had done missile tests, and they felt that at that point, you know, it's like your bargaining leverage, and it could start to reach a point of diminishing returns. And so now they're trying to use it, I think, for two objectives. One is for those security guarantees that say nobody's going to come in and change this government. The Kim dynasty will stay, and if it doesn't, it'll be something that happens inside North Korea, but not because of outside interference by the U.S. and others. And secondly, I do think there is a sense of starting to develop the economy. There was a team of journalists that went there a while ago, and one of them is a close friend and colleague, and said you can see some of the modernization compared to 5 or 10 years ago. I think they might like to try the China path, which is, you know, a degree of economic modernization without opening up politically. He's only 34 years old, Kim, mm-hmm. and I think he'd like to start to deliver to his people. They're not going to become a capitalist country, and the economics are not going to make them do things that hurt their security. But if he can use this leverage to, you know, be the leader that takes his country to the next step, that would be very fulfilling, I think, for his own sense of what it means to be the country's leader.
So back to this peace treaty, if we actually do sign a peace treaty and end our war with North Korea, and we demilitarize, is Kim going to be satisfied with just being the leader of North Korea?
I think so. The unification question is complicated. Even South Koreans, you know, one of the things they did start to do in the 1990s was reunification of families. You know, at a very human level, families that have been separated back in the early 1950s. Some of that, I think, has resumed because of the relations between the two Korean leaders. You know, the reality is many of that generation have passed away, but they're still descendants of them. And so South Koreans look at Germany and German unification and say, well, that's pretty expensive for Germany and for Europe. Maybe we want that someday, but it's not. We haven't made that decision yet. And I don't think North Korea believes that it's going to rule South Korea. So unification, I think, could be a goal, would have very little to do with us. It would really be about those two. The question for the United States and China then would become, is it a neutral country, or is the whole unified Korea, China, I don't think, would want that to be an American ally.
Mm.
So lots of questions that I don't think are as pressing. Ending the war would be important. That demilitarized zone is very dangerous. I tell people I was there, and it's the most dangerous golf hole in the world. They allow you to hit like a pitching wedge to the green that's about 110 yards away. And if you make the green, you can go putt. If you don't, you can't get your ball because all the area is landmine. So that's what it's like up there.
So could North Korea's nuclear arsenal actually be compromised? There were reports last fall that there was some sort of landslide or some sort of crater that had developed in the mountain that they launched nuclear tests from. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's where, you know, this happened with Iran. There was this computer virus that went by the name of Stuxnet that some combination of the United States and Israel had managed to feed into and infect part of the Iranian nuclear complex that didn't fully disable it, but hit it, you know, fairly hard and demonstrated that there was this capability. And then we did have an Iranian president get elected, you know, who was interested in improving relations. So I think there's so many aspects to the North Korean nuclear complex that there's no way that covert action could fundamentally disable it. They have so much going, and they've developed it to such a point that even in a best case and good intention scenario, it would really take at least a decade and very complicated work. Who would do it? They're not going to let the United States come in on their own. It would be the international organization called the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA. Well, you'd have to probably triple the IAEA's budget to have enough inspectors and experts to go in and do it. So notions that somehow we could disarm them, you know, militarily or covertly, most reasonable people say, you know, no way.
But have they kind of shot themselves in the foot is maybe a wrong metaphor, but have they over-tested and have they damaged their own facilities?
They could have. You know, that's a technical question that's beyond my expertise. But it would only be a portion of their facilities. The sites that they've agreed to blow up, you can do a lot of testing of weapons. We do a lot of testing of weapons through computer simulation. You don't necessarily need the physical site. So in their willingness to make these first moves of disabling and blowing up some sites and allowing journalists to watch them do it, doesn't mean that they can't continue to refine and develop their nuclear complex. It was a show of good faith, and it was a show, as you were saying, that they've reached a level of technological capability that they don't need those, you know, physical launch sites as much as they did before.
We are talking about the historic summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un that was held in Singapore yesterday. We're also going to be talking about the G7 summit that preceded it. We are taking your calls, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll be back in a moment. We'll be right back. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. After meeting with Kim Jong-un, the President Donald Trump had these upbeat remarks.
We have developed a very special bond. So people are going to be very impressed. People are going to be very happy. And we're going to take care of a very big and very dangerous problem for the world.
We're talking to Bruce Gentleson about last night's summit and about the G7 meeting before it. We are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. Do you think that this summit was a good idea? Do you think that it will result in something that looks like a lasting peace? How do you think this will affect the U.S.'s relationship with allies like Canada, especially after President Trump refused to sign a G7 communique over the weekend and called Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau weak? Are you concerned about the U.S.'s relationship with its allies in the future? 1-800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Bruce Gentleson, I want to go back to what Trump just said. It reminds me of what Bush said, what George W. Bush said about looking into Putin's soul. And what was the result of that?
Yeah, interesting comparison. You know, the chemistry between leaders can be very important. Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev developed an enormous warmth between them that helped them work out, you know, huge differences in the way they saw the world. Henry Kissinger and Joe Enlai developed this great respect for each other that also helped there. But there can be too much emphasis on that. And, you know, when people say, look, I really met the guy and I really know where he's coming from, or the woman, and they've met him once. I mean, people can think about that in their personal life with colleagues at work or relationships or friends. That's a pretty weak basis on which to draw conclusions. And your George W. Bush example was one that reinforces the point. And somehow Trump's notion that, especially with somebody so different, you know, somebody said it's like, if you look at the way these guys grew up, they're like from different planets. And so I think that was just Trump trying to say, I know better than you, and I don't really need to know anything else other than what I kind of think myself.
You know what? They're from different planets, but in many ways, they were raised in the same way. They both come from very privileged backgrounds. They both were sort of shielded from the outside world. They both went to the same kinds of boarding schools. I believe Kim Jong-un went to Switzerland to go to boarding school. They have a lot of things in common. Yes.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think that's right. I think the two planets takes it way too far. You know, I think they grew up in different cultures and systems. But I think there is this, you know, Trump has shown that he likes leaders that impose their will. He's been much, you know, more kind and positive towards Putin, towards the Turkish leader Erdogan, towards the Saudi king, towards now North Korea, toward, he even called, in the press conference this morning, he called President Xi of China terrific. And so he does like that kind of personality, even if there are differences in, you know, the culture and the part of the world compared to the way he treats, you know, the leaders of, you know, Prime Minister Trudeau or, you know, German Chancellor Merkel or President Macron. He said, we had a great chemistry. We had dinner together in the top of the Eiffel Tower. And now Macron is, you know, along with Trudeau,
right,
leading the pushback against Trump.
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about Trudeau and Macron and the G7 summit over the weekend. Trump left that G7 summit blasting his host, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, and calling him weak. And interestingly enough, he called him weak because Trudeau said, we're not going to let the U.S. push us around, which I thought was kind of strange.
Exactly. Yeah, Trudeau wasn't the one that initiated, you know, the altercation. He was just responding to it. And you could make an argument that if he didn't respond to what Trump had done, that would be weak rather than responding. It's very, you know, the G7 was formed in the mid-70s as a way for, outside of NATO, the Western democracies to work together, largely on economic issues. It was back during the OPEC oil embargo days. And, you know, they've been important meetings, and I think that there have been disagreements, but never like this. And the whole trade issue, you know, in Wisconsin, you have people who are affected by the unfair trade barriers that other countries have, and you have people who benefit from the U.S.'s own, frankly, unfair trade practices.
Right.
It's not a one-way street. If you add up the total tariffs in Canada, they're actually lower than the United States. And to do this from the plane in a tweet after you leave, you know, it's just at every level, even just taking it to the human level, this isn't the way people are supposed to treat each other, let alone leaders of countries.
So it has occurred to me that Trump did this kind of on purpose as he was heading into the summit with North Korea. Do you think that there was a strategy here?
One of his aides said the reason he did it was because he didn't want to be seen as weak and pushed around. And I actually think if that was true, it was a total miscalculation. Because for Kim, it could be, he doesn't even have good relations with his friends. So he doesn't have that much leverage to bring to bear on me. And as long as I don't get blamed for any failure in the relationship, sanctions will probably get loosened by a bunch of countries, not just China. And I can, like, reverse this leverage in ways that serve my interests. And so if that was the motivation, separate from anything else that's wrong with it, big, big miscalculation strategically.
You know, it also occurred to me last night that we've got this G7 summit that blew up. Our allies were fighting with our allies. And then Trump goes to meet with a dictator, with an authoritarian dictator. It seems to me like this is Putin's biggest dream come true. Is there something that do we suspect that maybe there's some manipulation happening behind the scenes with Putin?
Hard to say. Special Counsel Mueller presumably, is continuing to look at all aspects of the relationships between Trump, his family, his business, and the Russians, I think going back a ways. Putin did make a statement the other day which kind of said, well, maybe we've been trying to mess around in the EU in elections and in the Brexit vote, but kind of now we can just sit back. If our goal is to weaken the unity in the Western alliance, we can sit back. I can go to my Black Sea resort and, hang out a little bit. So I don't know. I don't think that there's a direct on this Trump to Putin. Trump, this just fits Trump in so many ways. He lashes out. This whole notion that in business he was a great deal maker has been way overblown. And he's used to lashing out. Even there, if he'd make a deal with a small company, say a cabinet maker for his hotel, he wouldn't fulfill the deal.
Right.
And he was used to being the big guy and pushing the little guy around. And that's the way he views the world.
Bruce Gentleson is a professor of public policy and political science at Duke University. He's been helping us make sense of this North Korean summit and the G7 summit that came before it. Bruce, thank you for being with us today.
Great. Good talking with you. And thanks for having me.
Democratic gubernatorial candidate Kelda Royce has put her young family front and center in her gubernatorial campaign as part of WPR's series on the candidates for governor. State Capitol reporter Laura White has this profile.
Kelda Royce's campaign got a major boost earlier this year when she released a video that shows her breastfeeding her then 4-month-old daughter.
Honey.
Okay.
The video got coverage across the country and the world by outlets like the BBC, CNN, Glamour Magazine, and The Today Show. Roy says she didn't plan to record herself breastfeeding for the ad, but when it needed to happen, she decided to stay in front of the camera because she thought it was something voters should know about her and might appreciate.
Sometimes I think it's hard, especially for women, to be taken seriously as professionals when they're also seen as parents, and it's past time for that too. Be the case.
Roy's family is a big part of her campaign. She sometimes takes her baby, Avalon, and her other young daughter, Arcadia, to campaign events around the state.
Sometimes the issue is, I'll have a grandparent along and they'll say, I didn't get to hold Avalon at all because everybody in the Democratic Party of Ozaukee County wanted to hold the baby.
On this particular day, Roy's will work from home in the morning. That means saying goodbye to Arcadia as she leaves for school.
Love you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Roy settles onto the couch in her home office. Avalon wiggles in her lap while her mom juggles the baby, a laptop, and a jumbo-sized thermos of coffee.
Yeah. That's it, 9:40. Oh, recording the LCB video.
At 38, Royce is one of the youngest Democrats running to challenge Scott Walker in the fall. She says she brings the energy and enthusiasm necessary to fire up Democrats.
We can't win in Wisconsin without engaging our progressive base and giving them a reason to show up at the polls and getting more young voters, voters under 50, to the polls.
Royce represented Madison in the state assembly from 2009 until 2013. Cecily Castillo first met Royce in 2007.
She was young and brilliant, and she had a plan.
Castillo went on to be Roy's chief of staff in the legislature. She says a highlight of their work together was implementing a bill that banned the chemical BPA from kids' sippy cups. Before her time in the assembly, Royce was the executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Wisconsin. Marie Griffith, a professor of political science at Washington University in St. Louis, says that could be a problem for Royce, particularly if she makes it to the general election.
I certainly think this will become an issue for her.
Griffith has written a number of books on the overlap between morality and politics. She says surveys have shown many Americans support abortion, at least in some cases, but she says it's become a difficult political issue.
The anti-abortion movement has, really been very successful at spreading a message that abortion is murder. And once you say abortion is murder, there's not really a lot of middle ground.
Griffith says it may be especially hard for Royce because she's not just pro-choice, but made money off the pro-choice movement through her employment. But Royce says she's proud of her work with NARAL. She considers it a big part of what makes her a good candidate. She says Democrats aren't going to beat Scott Walker this fall unless they engage with the party's progressive base, and that she's the progressive candidate to do it. Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Our coverage of the 2018 governor's race continues tomorrow at this time with another profile. You can find Wisconsin Public Radio's stories about the gubernatorial candidates at WPR.org/governor. This is The Morning Show, and I'm Carrie Kaufman. You are listening to the Ideas Network.